Welcome, everybody. This is the, what is it, sixth office hours session for the Mises Academy 2012 spring edition of Principles of Economics. And as always, I'm here to throw open the discussion to the people who are tuned in live. So if you guys got anything, go ahead and type it right into the chat box there. Okay, while you guys are thinking, let me elaborate a little bit on the case for free trade. Because okay, good. So George says, can you spend a little time on the unilateral defense of free trade? Okay, yeah, that's a great question. So, yeah, as I was saying before, fortunately, George's question reinforced the point. You know, I got done with Wednesday's lecture, so that would have been the lecture 6 in the course, for those of you who are listening to this stuff after the fact. And it's not that anything I said was wrong in there, but I felt like, well, man, if that's all anyone ever heard about free trade with the hour and a half lecture I just gave, it wouldn't be enough. And so I see Michael's asking about career choices. Yeah, Michael, just go ahead and post your stuff, and then that'll help me regulate how much time I spend on the free trade stuff. So go ahead and type out your question so I can see it. It's not that I regret anything I said or that, you know, I should have spent less time on one. It's just it's a super important topic, and it's hard to collapse it all into an hour and a half. And so I realized part of what I didn't get across in the lecture, and so I really encourage you. I know some people are busy and they're just, you know, they don't have time to read the textbook and they just tune in for my lectures, like maybe you listen to it in your car or something like that, or at the gym. And so if you're that kind of person, then you really, I do encourage you to read the textbook chapter on tariffs and quotas, because there's more stuff in there than I can get across. But anyway, what I didn't go over specifically in the lecture, and this is one of the quiz questions dealt with this, and that jogged my memory, and I realized, oh my gosh, I didn't talk about this. It has to do with what happens with the winners and the losers from free trade or from a tariff. And then I will come around eventually, George, and hit your specific question there. So let me just go over this a little bit. So let's say we start initially in a position of free trade. Okay, so you got two countries and they have no tariffs against each other, so goods move freely just based on profitability. The consumers in one country can shop for the products that are either the cheapest or the highest quality or the best combination of those two attributes that they want, and it doesn't matter where the good was made. Right, so there's no institutional distinction between electronics made and by workers in their own country in a factory that's located physically within their own country's borders, or whether it happens to be manufactured in some neighboring country. It doesn't matter. I mean, shipping costs and stuff might affect it, but the point is the governments of the respective countries don't put further obstacles in the way of trade. So it's just pure market forces determine where industries are located and what jobs people have and that kind of stuff. So now in that setting, if the government of one of the countries comes in and levies a big tariff, let's say on cars produced in the other country, what's going to happen? Well, that will immediately raise the price of those cars to the consumers who are in the country that just put the tariff in place. All right, so just so we don't get mixed up, let me just be concrete and say it's the U.S. versus Japanese cars, just so I can be a little bit more concrete in this story. And you know, you can not get lost in the story. All right, so if the U.S. government puts in place a big tariff on Japanese cars, then what does that do? All of a sudden, overnight, Japanese cars now to American consumers are more expensive, because whatever the price was before, now on top of that, they're paying the tariff to the U.S. government. So from the U.S. car buyer's point of view, you know, originally we were in an equilibrium, and some people bought Japanese cars and some people bought U.S.-made cars, and now that equilibrium is disturbed, because all of a sudden Japanese cars just got, whatever, 50% more expensive if the tariff is 50%. So what happens? Well, obviously now fewer people are going to buy Japanese cars, and they're going to switch and start buying more American-made cars. So if you think through the analysis of supply and demand curves, what happens, so a Japanese car is a substitute for an American car from the U.S. consumer's point of view. Remember, because a substitute means it's a good or a service that fulfills kind of the same basic need or goal or whatever from the consumer's point of view. And so what it means, you know, the technical feature of a substitute is when the price of a substitute goes up, the demand for that thing substitutes goes up. All right, so it's not that the demand for Japanese cars goes down. We're just moving along the demand curve, right, because of the price changed. But since the equilibrium price now of Japanese cars is going to be higher, that will cause the actual whole demand curve for U.S. cars to increase, because U.S. and Japanese cars are substitutes for most people. All right, so then because the demand for U.S. cars increases and the new equilibrium, their price is higher, and what does that do? U.S. automakers now think that the productivity of U.S. workers in the automobile industry has gone up, because now they can sell their cars for a higher price. And so if it was, you know, before when they are optimizing and hire just enough workers to balance the marginal productivity with wages and so forth, now all of a sudden they're making a lot more per car. And so they're going to want to hire more workers and expand auto production. All right, so when all is said and done, when the dust settles, U.S. workers in the automobile industry are going to have higher wages, and there's going to be more people in that industry. So if you had previously been an unemployed auto worker, right, you were trained, you had a lot of skills working, you know, like in a Ford plant or something, but then because business was bad, you got laid off, and you were applying for other jobs, but they weren't very good offers, and you were really just hoping you could get a job making cars again, that tariff is going to be good for you. And so if you say, you know, is a tariff good or bad for Americans, the correct answer is to say, or the precise answer is to say, the tariff on Japanese cars helps some Americans and it hurts other Americans. So when, you know, when we say like free trade is economically efficient or make statements like that, that doesn't mean every single person in a country will benefit financially or in terms of their standard of living if the country originally had tariffs and then moved towards free trade. Because I just showed you going from free trade to a position of a tariff on Japanese cars could make some U.S. workers and, you know, shareholders and U.S. automaker companies would be better too. You know, the profits of those companies would go up and they would be able to issue a higher dividend and so forth. So, but then who's, so what's the downside? Well, the downside is all the various people now that are made poor in the United States. So obviously U.S. car buyers are hurt. You don't help U.S. car buyers by making some of their choices artificially more expensive. Even people who didn't like Japanese cars, even people who always buy, you know, oh, I buy American, those people are hurt because now the increased demand for U.S. cars ends up making U.S. cars more expensive. So even somebody who didn't support Japanese cars and always bought American anyway, the tariff on Japanese cars makes that person poorer. He now has to spend more the next time he wants to go buy an American car than he would have in the absence of the tariff. Okay, so clearly U.S. consumers, U.S. car consumers are poorer because of this. And then there are other people that are hurt too. That remember we said sort of general long-term way of thinking about it is that ultimately a nation pays for its imports with its exports. So if we are now importing less from abroad because now Americans aren't buying as many cars from Japan, other things equal, that's going to mean foreigners are able to buy less from the United States. And so what ends up happening is U.S. exporters are going to be hurt. So maybe farmers who grow wheat and sell that on the world market, maybe they're going to be hurt. And so, you know, if you really want to get into the details and say, well, what's the actual mechanism? How does that happen? Well, if Americans don't want to buy as many Japanese cars now, then that means ultimately there's fewer people going to the foreign exchange market with U.S. dollars to trade for yen. And so that means the dollar strengthens the currency markets. So if the dollar now is stronger against the yen, then that means U.S. goods that are originally priced in dollars are now more expensive to Japanese people. So Japanese millers who used to buy U.S. wheat to turn it into flour so they could make it bread for Japanese consumers in their grocery stores, now all of a sudden the dollar is stronger against the yen, so U.S. wheat now all of a sudden seems more expensive to them, so they're going to buy less of it. All right, so that's this specific mechanism by which this stuff occurs. But the point is, you know, the big picture, if you think about a nation paying for its imports by exporting stuff, which is correct to a first approximation, I mean, there's complications, but that's, you know, this for an introductory class, that's an okay way to think about it. Well, if the U.S. now is importing fewer cars from Japan, then that kind of means there's pressure for foreigners now to not be able to buy as much stuff from the U.S. I mean, that's one way of thinking about it. If the U.S. is sending money abroad to buy goodies from foreigners, now those foreigners have dollars with which to buy stuff from us. And so if now we're buying less stuff from foreigners, we're not sending out as many dollars, the foreigners have fewer dollars with which to buy our stuff. So yeah, it helps domestic U.S. producers because now they have less competition from foreigners, but those U.S. producers who are net exporters, like farmers, because the U.S. sends food abroad to the world, U.S. grows way more food than Americans eat of that type of food. And so we are net exporters. Like Saudi Arabia is a net exporter of oil. The U.S. is a net exporter of farm products. And so, and this goes hand in hand with saying all a tariff really does is rearrange employment. So employment expands in the auto industry, and it contracts in those industries that are net exporters. So like the farm sector gets hit, and maybe they don't have to hire as many workers, or they don't buy as much fertilizer, and so the fertilizer manufacturers have to lay off workers, that kind of stuff. Okay, so what we can, so again, there's going to be losers and winners from a change in tariff policy. If you had free trade originally, boom, the U.S. government all of a sudden puts in place a tariff on Japanese cars, that is going to help workers in the U.S. auto industry. Now you might say, well, but aren't they hurt in their role as consumers? Yeah, they are. So if you work in the auto industry and it just so happens that your family's car is real old and you have to get a new car, you're actually hurt by the tariff too in that little aspect of your life, because now cars are more expensive for you just like they are for everybody else. Well, again, whether you were going to buy a Japanese car, probably if you worked in the U.S. auto industry, you wouldn't dare buy a Japanese car unless you get shot. And I'm not even kidding. I mean, you wouldn't get shot, but I know people that lived in near Detroit, and they said that people that worked at the factories there, like if somebody for some stupid reason drove a Japanese car and left it in the parking lot, like it would just be all keyed up and everything when the auto workers came out. So you, if for some reason you really had an affinity for Toyotas, you wouldn't let your friends know that if you worked at a U.S. auto plant. Okay, but so whether you buy Japanese car or whether you buy American cars, still in your role as a consumer, even if you're a U.S. auto worker, you have less money to work with. You know, it's more expensive for you. So when you replace that car, you're out the extra, whatever, $3,000 or however much the tariff ended up raising their prices. But you're still better off probably on the whole because you're going to gain more in your wages than you're going to lose the occasional time that you have to go buy a car. Okay, so you're still on net better off from the tariff if you're a U.S. auto worker, especially if you were unemployed and now get a job. Because so then you get to see the point that, yeah, sure, if I have to buy a car, it's a little more expensive, but I have the money in the first place because now I got a job thanks to the tariff. So that's the other, but then everybody else, if you're not in the U.S. auto industry and you're not a shareholder of U.S. automaker corporations, then you're just clearly hurt. And so when you say, well, gee, how can we say in the aggregate, whether it's an efficient or an inefficient policy, you can show through various types of arguments that generally speaking, you can always come up with crazy scenarios, but generally speaking, under a standard range of reasonable assumptions, putting in place a tariff is going to impose more harm on U.S. citizens than it will impose benefits on the people in this in the protected industry. And there's very one way of just seeing that is labor ends up getting diverted into its less productive outlets, right? So there's less total stuff being produced physically because the tariff rearranges global patterns of trade and it makes U.S. workers not specialize where they have the comparative advantage. They end up specializing where they don't have the comparative advantage. And the same thing in Japan. Now, if they're not able to get wheat, as much wheat from the U.S. because of that tariff on their own cars, that means more Japanese people have to go into wheat production than they otherwise would have. And that's not an efficient use of their labor, right? So there's less total stuff all around being made. So on average, the standard of living has to be lower. Okay, but to say a tariff makes the U.S. poorer on average is not the same thing as saying the tariff will make every single American poorer. Because again, what happens is some people benefit, some people lose. It's true the total losses to the losers outweigh the total gains to the gainers, but nonetheless, there can be specific individuals who on net gain. And that actually explains the politics of it. Because really what happens is the tariff, there's a small minority of Americans who do quite well because of it, and then the whole vast range of everybody else suffers a little bit. So for the average car buyer, whether you have a tariff on Japanese cars or not, in the grand scheme, it's not that big a deal. If you have to pay an extra $2,000 every 3 years when you buy a new car, I mean, that's not that big a deal. Whereas if you go from being unemployed to then having a $50,000 a year job working at a Ford plant, that's a huge deal. So you're going to go out and march and write letters to the editor and donate money to candidates who promise to protect American jobs. Whereas if you're just a regular consumer who has nothing to do with the auto industry, you're not going to get all fired up about the issue of tariffs on Japanese imports, Japanese auto imports. Okay, so that kind of explains how these policies manage to stay alive if they're so demonstrably inefficient, right? If a policy makes Americans poorer, you would think, well, then how come with a democratic system of government we don't just put in politicians who get rid of it? And it's because, this issue of concentrated benefits and dispersed harms. Okay, so finally, back to George Smith's question. Don't worry, George, I didn't forget. George says, could you spend a little time on the unilateral defense of free trade? And I think what he's getting at, and obviously, George, if I'm misunderstanding what you're asking, correct me. I think what George is getting at is that in the textbook I stressed, when you understand the case for free trade, you realize there's no reciprocity needed. All right. So a lot of times what happens is you'll hear political debates and candidates will say something like, or elected officials talking about their stance on the upcoming trade negotiations with some country. They'll say things like, oh, I believe in free trade, or I understand the benefits of free trade, but we just want to make sure that, we don't get the short end of the stick in this deal, that right now, country X, they have a lot of restrictions on U.S. exports into their country. And so before we sort of let down our guard and let their cheap products come in and destroy U.S. jobs, we want to make sure they do the same. So what they mean is we'll lower our tariffs as long as they lower their tariffs. And that's typically how these trade negotiations work, that countries who initially have restrictions on each other's goods will come to the bargaining table and will agree to, you know, okay, I'm going to lower all these restrictions on your goods, and then you do the same for our goods, and then we both win. And that's, I mean, that's a true statement, but it unfortunately can give the impression that if one country just lowered its tariffs and the other country didn't do anything, that that first country would, like, sort of be the sucker, and that they would be, you know. So what I'm trying to say is trade is not a prisoner's dilemma, if you understand what that term is. Okay, so in other words, lowering tariffs, and I'm writing this stuff out partly to just practice my handwriting with this thing. Lowering tariffs is good regardless of whether other country reciprocates. And if that's a $20 word for some people, meaning whether or not the other country lowers its tariffs doesn't matter. I mean, it matters. You want them to, but even if they don't, it's still better for your country to lower its tariffs. So Michael, in the question, is saying, is zero-sum game internationally? No, it's a positive-sum game. Well, I mean, it's, I get what you're saying, but that's not even really the right way to think about it. A prisoner's dilemma, and maybe I shouldn't have even brought up prisoner's dilemma, because I realize if I'm dealing with people who have never taken economics before, that's not very helpful to refer to something that's kind of advanced as an analogy. But in a prisoner's dilemma, what happens is the story behind it is that you got two prisoners or two, you know, criminals are caught committing a crime together, and so the police split them up, put them in different interrogation rooms, and they say to each guy, they say, look, we've got it on tape and everything. We've got the video surveillance camera and all that stuff, so we know you did it. We know your buddy did it, but we want to have a slam-dunk case in court, so we want you to testify and admit that you guys both committed this crime. You know, we don't want you going to the stand and saying you didn't do it, because then, you know, who knows what the jury's going to do. So we'll cut a deal with you. And if you testify and your partner doesn't, then you get then you go free, and we'll just throw him in jail for 10 years. If you both testify, then you'll each get 5 years. But if you don't testify and he does testify, then you're going to get 10 years. Okay, so if you run through the logic there, I hope I picked the numbers right, it turns out that, you know, each individual prisoner now thinking through the thing, he's like, well, okay, suppose my buddy testifies against me. If I testify too, then I get 5 years. If I don't testify, I get 10 years. So clearly, if I think he's going to squeal, I want to squeal also, because it's better to spend 5 years in jail than 10 years in jail. Suppose I think he is going to testify. Or sorry, he isn't going to testify. He's going to remain quiet and not throw me under the bus. Well, if I testify, then I walk. That's what the cops told me, and I forgot to tell you one other permutation. What if we're both silent? Well, maybe then they don't have enough to convict us on too much, and so we get like 6 months probation or something. Or we get 6 months in jail because they don't really have that much evidence without a confession. All right, and so I would rather, it's in my interest to testify and walk than to remain silent and get 6 months in jail or 6 months probation, whatever. Okay, so again, whether he testifies or whether he doesn't, the way the incentives have been set up, I, the prisoner, now find it rational, find it optimal to squeal and say we both did it, because either way, I do better by squealing than by remaining silent. But the reason it's a conundrum, the reason they call it it's a dilemma, is that the way I spell out those penalties, if each prisoner is rational in the narrow, short-sighted sense there, the individualistic sense, they both testified, and they're both going to get 5 years, because that was the numbers I picked, that if they both testify, they end up getting 5 years. Whereas if they were both quiet, they would only get 6 months. So it's a weird structuring of the incentives. And that, generally, that's what a prisoner dilemma is. It's not just about a case involving an actual person caught in a crime. That's just, that story is just to motivate the idea. So a prisoner's dilemma in economics means it's a situation where the incentives are structured such that when each individual person does what is optimal from his narrow perspective, everybody does worse than if everybody had done something that was more cooperative. Okay? So what I'm saying here is international trade is not like that. So, and that's the politicians and the other analysts who say things like, oh, we'll lower our tariffs so long as the other country agrees to lower theirs at the same time, they're making it sound like it is a prisoner's dilemma. They're making it sound like, you know, if we could just hold what everyone else did constant, we would do better by putting tariffs in place. But we recognize that that's dangerous. It's a slippery slope, because if we put our tariffs in place, then they're going to put their tariffs in place, and then we'll all be worse off than if we all had free trade. So that it sounds like it's a prisoner's dilemma. But I'm saying, don't think that. That's wrong. All right? Trade is not a prisoner's dilemma. So whether other countries put a tariffs in place or not, Americans are richer if the U.S. government gets rid of tariffs. All right? So yes, what do you mean? We're also richer if other countries get rid of their tariffs. That's true also. So yeah, if we both have tariffs up front, the best thing for everybody is if both countries get rid of their tariffs simultaneously. Then we're all as rich as can possibly be on average. But my point is, if the other side's playing hardball and they say, no, we're not lowering our tariffs, the correct response for the U.S., if what it wants to do is make Americans wealthier, is to say, okay, well, you're stupid. You're keeping your people poor for no reason. We're going to make our people richer. You guys do what you want. Right? So, I mean, it's sort of like if there were two countries that were adjacent and they were each threatening to drop an atomic bomb right on the border, you know, something that was going to hurt people in both countries. But, you know, the U.S. was going to drop its atomic bomb more inside the border of Mexico than Mexico was going to drop it more inside the border of the U.S. But either way, either drop is going to kill a lot of Mexicans and Americans. So what I'm saying is, you know, you could imagine saying them saying to each other, okay, well, we won't drop our bomb, but you better not drop yours. But if you thought they were going to drop the bomb either way, you don't help Americans by hitting them with more radiation. You know, it's the same kind of thing. That tariffs, yes, they hurt foreign producers. So back to our scenario, the U.S. government putting in place a tariff on Japanese cars, that does hurt Japanese automakers. Don't misunderstand. You know, I haven't focused on them. But yeah, it makes them worse off because now there's an extra tax on their product. And so they get less, the equilibrium price is going to drop. And so that's certainly true, that the U.S., or sorry, Japanese automakers are going to see less, a lower price per car than they would have before. And so they're certainly hurt. From their perspective, it looks like the demand has gone down for their product. So that's it's certainly true that you're hurting, but my point is it's not that the tariff hurts the foreigner and helps your people And so that, and you know, if that were the case, then yeah, it would make sense with trade negotiations for both sides to sort of bilaterally reduce the tariffs, and that way we'd all benefit. But that's not the situation. A tariff by the U.S. government, yes, hurts foreign producers, but it also hurts Americans on net. And so the reason for lowering your tariff is not so that you can do a favor for foreign producers and then you hope their government does a similar favor for your producers. That's not the rationale. The correct economic rationale is the U.S. government, by lowering tariffs on foreign products, makes Americans richer on average. Yes, it might hurt some American producers, but it more than offsets that by helping consumers. And this also ties into why you would want to, it would be better to have like a sweeping tariff reform movement rather than just doing them piecemeal. Okay, because let's go through the logic. You could say, okay, well, if you just admitted, Dr. Murphy, that the U.S. government putting a tariff in place helps U.S. automakers more than it hurts them, because you know they're in their role is, you know, the paycheck they get now goes up by more than the price they have to pay occasionally when they buy a new car. Well, why don't we then, you know, so but we say, oh, you know, wheat farm, not wheat, I'm trying to think of somebody else. Doctors are hurt, okay, because doctors, their wages don't go up just because the auto industry is protected from Japanese car imports, and yet the doctor now, when he has to buy a new car, has to pay more, so he's clearly hurt. So you say, well, let's help the doctor. Let's put a tariff in place on, there are these, on the ability to outsource. You know, there's these things where hospitals now, they can like fax or email MRI information to doctors in India, and then they look at the information over there, and then they send the diagnosis back. So that possibility clearly hurts U.S.-based doctors, right, because now they get less business. So what if the U.S. government tries to help them out? And it puts in, you know, restrictions on that kind of trade, keeping out the competition from the Indian doctors. So what happens there? Well, again, that restriction on trade, it probably helps U.S. doctors on net because their salaries or wages go up. And who does it hurt? Well, it hurts anyone who's a medical consumer. Anyone who wanted to go get an MRI and get the results now has to pay more, or their insurance company does, or you know, whoever pays for it. Because now those things are more expensive because you kept out cheap foreign imports. So you could do that. And then you say, okay, so now we, you know, the tariff on Japanese cars helped the automakers and it hurt everybody else, but now we'll put in a tariff or a restriction on the cheap doctors' analysis services to help the U.S. doctors, so now they're better off. You know, yeah, they have to pay more for cars, and they have to pay more if they themselves ever need an MRI done, but the increase in their paycheck more than offsets that. Okay. But now you've got two groups of producers who are better off, but now the mass of consumers is really hurt. And you can just keep doing one more industry at a time. You can just keep protecting more and more industries. But the point is, eventually, you're going to be raising the prices of everything so much by cutting off more and more international trade that eventually even the people who are protected are going to be worse off. You know, so the U.S. automakers, if now, you know, when it was just Japanese imports that were kept out, they clearly benefited. You know, their paycheck went up $10,000, and the new car they had to buy every 3 years was now $2,000 more. So clearly they make out financially from that change. But now they start saying, oh, and now MRIs are more expensive. Oh, and now oranges are more expensive. And now champagne is more expensive, and now crude oil is more expensive, and more and more things start getting more expensive because more and more industries are being protected. Eventually, the fact that your paycheck is $10,000 higher because they kept out those Japanese imports, and you work in a Ford plant, now that higher paycheck is more than offset by how much more expensive everything is as they try to protect more and more industries. And so the point is, it doesn't matter where you draw the line. It's always going to be the case under normal circumstances. Like I say, you can come up with contrived scenarios. But generally speaking, if each individual tariff is a bad thing in the sense that it hurts more Americans than it benefits Americans on net, adding more and more of that, all that's going to do is eventually make it the case that there's no one who's a net winner. Just, you know, randomly speaking, if every time you put in one more tariff, that tariff by itself imposes more financial hardship on the mass of people, and it just has very specific concentrated benefits, well, if you keep doing those things where the beneficiaries and the people who are harmed are different in each round, eventually, with multiple rounds of that, there's going to be basically nobody left who's better off compared to free trade. Okay, so going in reverse, what I'm saying is we start out in an initial situation where there's lots of tariffs in place. Instead of trying to remove them one at a time, where there's going to be intense opposition from that one protected group, and it's not going to be doing that much benefit for the mass of consumers just getting rid of that one tariff, if instead you could just get rid of them all in one fell swoop, that might be better, or that might be more politically feasible. Because now the consumers are going to say, whoa, you know, my standard of living just went up 15%. The prices of so many things I buy just got cheaper. And, and then even people in the protected industries might say, you know, this isn't so bad. Yeah, my paycheck went down by $10,000, but everything that I buy, the store, and then my gas bill went down and my electricity bill went down and da-da-da-da-da. So actually, I'm not that much worse off. And so I'm not going to, you know, march on Washington to protect this tariff. All right, so that's the idea. So again, one last thing for George's question there. By a nation reducing its tariffs, it makes its own people better off in any way you want to measure that objectively in terms of their standard of living, how many goods and services they can consume per year. And so, you know, if you want to have some strategic bargaining thing where you think if you threaten another country that we're not going to get rid of our tariffs unless you do, okay, you can go for the gold. But the point is, if they call your bluff, realize that by you keeping that tariff in place, you actually are hurting your own people. So in a sense, if you say to another country, we're not lowering our tariffs unless you reciprocate, what you're really saying is, you better stop hurting your people and our people, because if you don't, we're going to continue to hurt our people and your people. And that's not the way these things are typically couched. So that's one way of putting it is, the reason you get rid of tariffs is not so that you can boost your exports. The reason you get rid of tariffs is to make your people richer, to cause production to get reallocated to raise the standard of living. Yeah, it is true that the way that happens is your exports are going to go up, but so are your imports going to go up. Because all that does is it allows there to be more specialization, and so your country's people and resources are going to concentrate in the areas where they're good at, and so they're going to export more because they're making more of that thing than your own people want to consume. And then other countries are going to reallocate what they do and specialize more in their comparative advantage to send you more of that thing. So yeah, when you open up trade, exports increase and so do imports. So it's the point of reducing trade barriers is not to create jobs so we can export more because exporting is good and importing is bad. No, that's totally wrong. Okay. Michael says, one last thing on the trade stuff. George says, I liked your explanation in the book and lecture that begins with a crazy father restricting his family to trading only with his family. Was that a Bastiat analogy? I could be wrong, George, but I think that's my analogy. I think I made that up. I mean, I'm probably not the first person to go down that path, but the way that starts is you say, if what I clearly did not make up, what other people have said is, if you think having a tariff wall protecting the U.S. makes sense, or whatever country you live in, you know, somebody in Germany thinking, oh, we want to have tariffs to protect German industry. If you think that makes sense, well, then you should also think that tariff barriers around smaller jurisdictions make sense. You know, so if you're an American and you think keeping out goods from Mexico and Canada and Japan make Americans richer, well, if you live in Florida, don't you think then that keeping out goods that are made in Georgia or in Tennessee make Floridians richer? And if you think that, well then, you know, then, so I think I was the one who extended it to the individual household and tried to show it that way. So, anyway, so I believe that was my analogy. Okay, Michael finally says, okay, I would like to be an economist and currently transferred to a four-year working on a math major econ minor. There is no econ major here, but I was thinking of going to graduate school in econ at GMU, which is George Mason University, in the future. Is there a career like a financial analyst that would be a good preparation for an economist career? What would be good classes to take? Okay, so first of all, yeah, don't worry about not being an econ major. If somebody's going to go on to grad school, particularly if you're thinking about a doctoral program, then you want to take as much math as you can, as early as you can. I went to NYU, which was a fairly technical school in the sense that, you know, it was a pretty rigorous program, and you had to know a lot of math compared to other econ departments. And the stuff we did there was like measure theory, like, you know, knowing things like what's an uncountable set. You know, it's not merely that it has an infinite number of elements, but an uncountably infinite, you know, that kind of those weird distinctions. And, you know, things like something could have an event could have probability zero of occurring, but yet it's not impossible, you know, that kind of stuff. And then also a lot of econometrics. That was my weakest area in terms of the math. Like I had trouble with that. And also like linear algebra, anything that you could do in that respect. So those kind of areas, so for the econometric, like, you know, if you just were good at statistics and really understood regression analysis and you know, random variables and that kind of stuff, then at least if you went into a program like NYU's, you would be way ahead of the game, because that kind of stuff I did not have a good background in. I picked it up quickly, but the point was I had to go learn a bunch of math on the side in my first year of grad school, and I was not prepared for that, and it was kind of overwhelming. And the other thing, too, is I think if you just do, in other words, you don't need to be in an undergraduate econ department, because you can pick that stuff up elsewhere. You know, you can go to Mises.org, you can go to Mises University, you can read Steve Landsberg's blog, my blog, you know, the econ law guys or whatever. I mean, you can go read Henry Hazlitt's book. You can read Bastiat. So my point is, you don't need to be in an official program to teach you free market economics at an intuitive level in undergrad. And you know, just to understand, how do I interpret the world from a free market perspective? How do I interpret the news or the political issues of the day from a free market perspective? You don't need an undergraduate college professor teaching you that stuff. You use the internet, and you've got tons of that stuff. But you probably do need a college undergrad degree to force you to, you know, the discipline to make you go and take tests in linear algebra and stuff like that, or Calc 3, because that stuff's not intrinsically as much fun, and so you're probably not going to really learn all that stuff unless someone's forcing you to do it, just because it's kind of, you know, that's different from reading about minimum wage legislation. So yeah, if you want to go to grad school, I think it's fine that you're a math major and an econ minor. Don't worry about that. Yeah, then your follow-up, like a financial analyst, good. I'm a little bit less sure about what to tell you about your ultimate career thing. I mean, what I just told you was definitely true if you want to get a PhD in economics, that you want to have as much math as you can. But if you're saying, what do you mean? You want to, is that what you want? Do you want to get a PhD, or you're not sure? Okay, you do want to get a PhD. Okay. When you say an economist career, do you mean you want to be a professor at a university, or you're not sure? Not sure, but leaning towards consulting or research. You basically want to be Bob Murphy when you grow up. That's what you're telling me. All right. Well, let me okay. So for sure, anybody who wants to teach at a college or a university and have that be their career, you want to get a PhD in economics. And that's the end of the story there. Now, having said that, is that the only outlet? Well, no. I mean, for example, I only taught for 3 years at Hillsdale College, and I have a PhD in economics, and my career path was incredibly odd, or I don't know what you want to call it. It's not what I would have planned or designed, and at certain points when forces compelled me to switch directions, it was not comfortable, but I mean, I'm making a decent amount of money right now, and I have a totally wide open schedule. I mean, I work a lot. I probably work, I don't know, 60 hours a week. But the point is, I can work when I want to. You know what I mean? Like, I don't actually have a boss, and if my son has a soccer practice and I want to go to that, I can just go to it, and then I just stay up late that night and you know, stay on top of my work. So, I mean, that's really awesome, and I'm a consultant, in case people don't know that. So I own the company Consulting by RPM. I'm RPM, in case it's not clear. But it's, I think, I kind of had a strange combination of circumstances that allows me to get away with this, that I, you know, I can write a lot very quickly, and so I can make enough from just writing stuff for various outlets that it works, whereas I'm amazed that it does work. But the point is, it can be done with the internet and so forth. And teaching online classes is another thing. You know, there's this class right now. I mean, in terms of, I've never run the numbers. I probably make more teaching classes for the Mises Academy than I would at a standard liberal arts school in terms of, you know, my hours of time that I have to put into it and whatever, you know what I'm saying, all that stuff. So it's the internet is opening things up. And there's lots of think tanks. So that's the thing that I didn't really know much about when I was in grad school. So when I was in grad school getting my PhD, I thought the only thing that for me was going to be go to a college or a university and just be a professor for the rest of my life and then, you know, write academic articles and books and just be the grand poobah and smoke a pipe and pontificate. That's what I thought I was going to do. And that didn't work out like that. I had to go in the financial sector. But that's, how can I put it? Economists are actually, fortunately for those of us who are interested in being economists, we are branching out and more people are retaining our services. Okay, so when I was trying to get in the financial sector back in 2006, I was like trying to get jobs on Wall Street, and actually it was not good that I had a PhD in economics. It would have been better if I had a PhD in physics or in math or like in electrical engineering to get a finance job, believe it or not, because the kind of job I was going for was to be like one of those quantitative analysts, or they call them quants, like working for a hedge fund and being the guy in the basement with Dan Aykroyd kind of cranking out the models and saying, well, these derivatives are going to, you know, if we structure them such and such, you know, the stuff that ended up blowing up back in 2006 when academia wasn't working out for me, that's what I went into. I was looking at because, first of all, it paid a lot of money. Secondly, you know, my wife and I both thought New York was cool, and we were thinking, well, that'd be cool to be able to live in New York again because I had gone to grad school at NYU. And also I thought that stuff fascinated me, you know, the derivatives and all. I mean, the math and stuff behind it is really interesting. And I had a physics background, so it wasn't that hard for me to pick the stuff up because in that area where they're pricing derivatives and things, they use a lot of the math that was developed for like electromagnetism and stuff. All right, so but what I discovered was they didn't like that I was an economist, that they would have preferred that I was just a pure math guy or a pure physics PhD, because the economist, one guy told me on the phone, he's like, nah, it was a job for working for a bank evaluating mortgage portfolios or something. He said something to me like, oh, you know what, I'm sorry, I'm looking here at your resume, I see you have a PhD, Nick. I'm sorry for wasting your time, I thought you had a math PhD. We don't like economists because you guys think everybody's rational, and that's what you build into your models as to when they're going to refinance their mortgages, and people aren't rational. Okay, and he hung up. So that was kind of funny. But, and especially since probably that guy got fired once his bank blew up 2 years later. But anyway, what I'm getting at, that was a long way of getting around to the point. I didn't even know about think tank. I mean, I knew what a think tank was, but I didn't even think of it. It didn't even occur to me that that would be somewhere that I could get hired, and that actually that would be a great fit for me if it were a free market oriented think tank, because then there you get to do research, you know, you crank out papers, you know, you do studies of things, and you're writing for the general public. I mean, that's the ultimate customer or client is, I mean, you know, you solicit donations from donors, but your market, as it were, is either, you know, politicians if you're trying to educate them, but really what you're trying to do is educate the people so that they go and they know how to, you know, lean on politicians to get legislation that they think is more sensible. So anyway, there's just tons of opportunity there. So it's, how can I put it? I'm not sure it makes sense to go get a PhD if ultimately you just want to work at a think tank and write for them, because you don't have to have a PhD. You can just be really sharp and work your way up through the ranks. Like a lot of the guys that I work with who have jobs at various free market think tanks do not have PhDs, and those guys are sharp. You know what I mean? It's not like they're a bunch of morons. I mean, they know more economics than a lot of PhD economists do. So, I mean, getting a PhD, it's a huge waste, not a huge waste, it's a huge commitment of time, Freudian slip. Getting a PhD is a huge commitment of time, and so you have to weigh the pros and the cons, and I'm saying, for sure, if you want to teach, especially like at a graduate level where you're overseeing people who are getting dissertations and stuff, obviously you yourself need to do that, but, so anyway, given that I had a PhD, that opens a lot of doors for me when my career path changed and I was trying to figure out where do I end up here. Because from the perspective of the think tank, it looks more credible. If they have a research report, you know, like I wrote for Pacific Research Institute, I wrote a proposal for reforming California's state income tax system. So it just looks better to have on the cover Robert P. Murphy, PhD. You know, and my co-author didn't have a PhD. And that guy knew a ton of stuff about tax policy, but just in terms of making the thing look official, it helped that I had those three letters after my name. I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm a good writer. My analysis, I think, was good. But the point is, having those three magic letters made me more marketable, and it made them more willing to have me be, you know, like a senior fellow in business and economic studies or whatever the heck my title was, because I have a PhD. So my point is that stuff all helps, but if what you want to do, if you know right at the outset you don't want to end up teaching at a university, you might not need to get a PhD. Michael says, okay, I am a 30-year-old welder, so is that going to be a problem starting older? Well, I mean, it's not going to be, I don't know. I mean, if you got accepted to a PhD program, your age wouldn't hurt you. In fact, it would help you. But I think you'd be less likely to freak out, like, because, you know, when we were there, most of us were in our mid-20s, and, you know, if we had a big test coming up, we would just freak out and go to the library and stay there till 2 a.m. every night studying for the thing, whereas, like, people who were older and were married and stuff, they were much more balanced because it was like, yeah, this is stressful, but it's not like, well, my kid had the flu last month, you know what I mean? Like, so they were less calm because they knew in the grand scheme of things, who cares about this test, and so they didn't freak out. So you would probably be more mature emotionally, and so you'd be able to handle the program better. I don't know if the admissions department is going to look more favorably on younger applicants. I mean, I have no idea, to be honest with you there. It is true getting jobs somewhere in a new field, I think they would rather have younger people. So, I mean, that would be one issue for you that, well, gee, if you're going to now have to spend 5 years getting a PhD, then you're going to be that much older by the time you're applying to places. So I don't know. But I'm not really the right person to ask because I've never been on the other side. I've never been, you know, at a think tank hiring. I imagine that wouldn't be as big a deal for there. I mean, I know guys who tried to switch careers and tried to get hired, like a guy who worked, you know, like for Moody's. Or no, he went to NYU and got a master's, and he came out in economics and came out, and he was, I don't know what his exact age was, but he was older. You know, there were plenty of people who were you know, had his degree and such, and they were 10 years younger, and they were getting jobs more easily because I think, you know, like the big banks and stuff, they want to groom somebody. They don't want some guy coming in his late 30s who already had his view of the world, and they couldn't, you know, basically brainwash and get him to be a Goldman Sachs man. You know, they didn't want to have to keep fighting. They'd rather get a 25-year-old who knows nothing, and then they can just mold them, and they know that guy's going to get along, go along with the program. So I think there's definitely that, but I think there's probably less of that in terms of a think tank environment where you're more autonomous. Like, they kind of want you to be an independent researcher, and you come up with ideas, and, oh, I want to do this. And then they say, oh, yeah, we can raise money to fund that subject. That sounds good. Where, you know, they're not telling you, this is what we want you to do on Monday, and this is what we want you to do on Tuesday, in which case they'd rather have somebody younger who's not going to have his own views of things. So I'm not really giving you specific answers, but I'm trying to give you a big picture, I guess. All right, well, that's all the time we got for today. Thanks, guys, for tuning in. And I guess, Michael, what I would do you should probably email Walter Block, because he has a whole list of schools that are friendly to Austrian economics and stuff like that. So you might just want to, you know, anyway, I'm just saying Walter Block fields a lot of career type questions, and I know he deals with this kind of issue, and he knows more about the big picture than I do. So you might email him too and tell him your situation. Okay, guys, I will see you on Wednesday.